You need a rifle with a scope for distance. You need a shotgun for close work, and you need a handgun for personal protection. I nodded my head as he sped up in pace and conviction. Four guns shy of a plan, I muttered. Four guns shy. Okay. Welcome to the country, son. Before I could buy a .22 or any gun, I handled the problem the Detroit way. Coming home one night during the ongoing cat door wars, I was about to turn into the driveway when a skunk waddled right in front of my SUV. I made an honest effort to avoid impact, but it was too late. The skunk was destroyed. My gun-toting neighbor collared me at a function a few months later. "Hey, Bruce, did that .22 solve your skunk problem?" he asked, smiling assuredly. "No, my Ford Explorer did. I haven't seen him since." Walk this way. Whenever I tell people where I live, they tend to nod their heads and say, "Oregon, sure looks beautiful." Being a snotty person who doesn't want any more humans invading, my response is always the same. "Oh, you'd hate it up there. It rains every day." Even though it does rain in Oregon, the amount varies greatly depending on where you live. My area, unbeknownst to me when I moved there, is known as the sunny Applegate Valley. Geographically, it's in a rain shadow, protected by the mighty Siskiyou Mountains, which run east and west, thereby blocking a ton of crappy weather coming north from California. I always wondered why a retired airline pilot would live in my neighborhood. The answer came in what he saw from the air during the winter months. The entire Rogue Valley, including the airport, was fogged in solid, while the Applegate Valley, being elevated and protected, was clear as a bell. The bottom line was that we had a lot of clear days to get outside, and I took full advantage. A pleasant discovery was literally in my backyard. The Sterling Mine Ditch Trail, a little-used recreational gem dating back to 1877, runs across BLM land. Gold was discovered in nearby Sterling Creek in 1854. Hydraulic mining became all the rage, whereby you channel water downhill and force it into smaller and smaller tubes until the subsequent pressure of water becomes powerful enough to rip entire creek beds and hillsides apart. For the Sterling Mine, water was diverted from the Little Applegate River along an earthen ditch, then diverted down to Sterling Creek, where the destruction began. The area is very lovely now, but 20-foot-high piles of river rock, randomly stacked up during the mining process, are still evident. The Sterling Ditch was in use until the 30s, and now humans can enjoy the fruits of some very obvious labor. Around 400 workers, mostly Chinese, dug a 3-foot-deep ditch at a 1% grade, just enough to move the water, that weaves in and out of serpentine hills for about 25 miles. It was quite a feat, and I thank the ghosts of the workers every time I take a pleasant jaunt on the almost level trail. Exposure to the elements comes with inherent risk. You could fall off a cliff or be attacked by a wild animal. On a really bad day, you might be mistaken for a leaping deer, shot dead by a drunk hunter. Or, perhaps worst of all, you could get poison oak. I grew up exposed to poison ivy, the Midwest version of this dreaded plant. Let me tell you, poison ivy can be annoying, but poison oak is nothing to scoff at. By some grace of the Almighty, I am barely susceptible to it, but I've seen my wife, daughter, and brother suffer the tortures of the damned from the three-leafed menace. Leaves of three, let them be, is what the almanacs say. No shit. If Ida even gets a small amount on her skin, it will boil and fester for weeks. Brother Don and I finished an epic walk one day. Don, with no prior exposure to poison oak, proceeded to jump directly into the jacuzzi. Poison oak spreads through its oil, and if you want to avoid getting a bad case of it, you need to lather up with a product like Technu before and after hikes to keep the oils from settling. A jacuzzi has just the opposite effect. It spreads the oils. Oh, Don was having the time of his life, unwittingly coating his entire body with poison oak and getting it deep into every fleshly crevasse. I'm not sure if it was the positioning of the jacuzzi jets or the poorly timed placement of his hands. Only Don knows for sure. But for whatever reason, the rash appeared to be worse around his groin. In years to come, whenever the subject arose, which was often, I referred to it as the day Don got ditch dick. Don would have much preferred looking for Bigfoot. There's a trail about 45 minutes from my house, off of which the Forest Service built an enormous trap in the 70s to catch him. That's right. Some joker approved my dad's taxpayer dollars, hopefully not much, to catch the elusive Sasquatch. Today, it's not more than a tourist oddity off Collings Mountain Trail near Applegate Lake. The design, a wood and chicken wire elevator of sorts, was supposed to descend on a not very elaborate pulley system and trap the big fella inside, should he choose to enter the completely uninviting, undisguised device. To my knowledge, no Bigfoots were ever captured or killed in this trap. It was a fun, if slightly whimsical, idea, but the Forest Service was much more likely to catch a lawsuit from this rusting liability than a new species. What's a BLM? My introduction to the Bureau of Land Management came at about 9 a.m. one Saturday morning when a helicopter, hovering shockingly close to my house, began a heli-logging operation. I could have hit the thing with a rock, it was so close. This startling reality made me get acquainted with this heretofore unknown government agency lickety-split. Who was BLM and what were they up to? The Bureau of Land Management administers 264 million acres, mostly in 12 western states. On land ownership maps, BLM areas are usually shaded in yellow. Look at a map of Nevada. It's about 75% yellow. Oregon is about 50% federal land. BLM tends to administer lower elevation lands while the Forest Service assumes stewardship of higher elevations. What can be done on BLM-administered land? Plenty. They oversee timber extraction, mining, grazing, fracking, road building, etc. About the only thing they don't currently allow is human habitation beyond 2 weeks of squatting. BLM was my neighbor on three sides, so I started to attend meetings, symposiums, and lectures on land stewardship, a subject that had always interested me. How to use land is also a divisive topic. Show 10 people a landscape, and you'll get 10 different opinions about what to do with it. The answers will range from do nothing to take it all. Southern Oregon is an AMA, an adaptive management area, something that was designated in the 90s with a revision of the Northwest Forest Plan. The AMAs recognize that not one size fits all with regard to land use. So 11 adaptive areas were designated to allow local and federal land managers more flexibility on approaches and decisions. The residents in our area have always been very vocal about land use issues, so our AMA focused on the ability of the public to give input and to influence decisions on the land around us. I was thankful for this designation. It meant that locals could get on a list to propose federal actions, and we would then have 90 days to respond with what are called scoping comments. As citizens, we aren't scientists, and we aren't hip to how many board feet can sustainably be removed from a given slope, but just fly over Northern California, Oregon, and Washington, and you'll see that some extraction policies should be revisited. Patchworks of clear cuts slash across the landscape like a chainsaw was given to a kid with ADD and told to go crazy. The West has wide open spaces and vast vistas, but it also has wide open strip mines and vast, denuded landscapes. I like to quote a neighbor of mine, Richard, who said, "I'm not against logging. I'm against bad logging." We all wipe our butts with toilet tissue. That redwood deck had to come from somewhere. Most of us still use an array of paper products every day. The trick is, how do you get the needed materials out without wrecking everything for generations to come? We have tried a lot of different extraction methods over the years, and most of those since the industrial age have been very destructive. I decided to submit my first scoping comments about some upcoming actions the BLM proposed. I was loath to use any kind of boilerplate language offered up by local greenies, and I knew that a long, bullet-listed, know-it-all letter might never be fully appreciated. So I upped the ante and submitted a short film called Shed Talk. Most submissions about how to manage our watersheds and our wildlife are very solemn. I picture women with long, straight gray hair, tearfully drafting heartfelt suggestions on their grandfather's manual typewriter. Shed Talk had me, dressed as Joe Local, in my shed, doing gags, and plenty of them. Why shouldn't spit takes and double entendre be used to make a serious point? People can be very bitchy and preachy in the world of environmental protection. Maybe a little sugar will help the scoping comments go down. I was told after the fact that my scoping comments were shown to a meeting of some 70-odd land managers at the Medford BLM headquarters. The gathering wasn't to honor how amazing my cheap jokes were, and they were amazing, but it was to exemplify to the managers that different people are living in the backcountry now. People with cameras and websites and Twitter accounts. Citizens are now armed, not with pitchforks or shotguns, but with the ability to communicate quickly, easily, and effectively to the outside world. Most people have never heard of the BLM. Local greenies here in Oregon call them the Bureau of Land Mismanagement. Others dismissively wave them off as feds. Opinions vary wildly about whether the BLM folks are saints or sinners. I suppose they are a little bit of both. In my personal experience, I find the BLM to be a decent bunch of local folks who are ultimately going to do what the bureaucrats in D.C. want them to do. The current administration is very resource extraction friendly. You can bet the BLM will be there to facilitate the removal of trees, and they'll frack themselves blue. Conversely, under the Clinton administration, the Northwest Forest Plan they introduced pretty much changed the way BLM had been doing business for decades, and it caused a stir in my community. The issue was and is that small hamlets in rural Oregon and elsewhere in the West are virtually landlocked, surrounded by federal land, and they can't grow like traditional towns. Because they can't expand, they have to rely heavily on subsidies from timber and other extractive industries for schools, roads, fire, police. The Northwest Forest Plan removed a large portion of harvestable land from the chopping block and provided for a 10-year subsidy to replace lost timber revenue, thereby encouraging rural communities to adapt and diversify their local economy. I'm not sure if it's human nature or not, but precious few of these towns used the decade to reimagine themselves, and they are now in even worse financial situation. The solution? Well, cut more trees, of course. Sheesh. As long as there is an overabundance of humans on this planet, we will not soon see the end of these use-slash-conserve debates. Shed Talk 2 is already in the works.
Wandy is his name.
Chapter 12, What's My Name?
Wandy is his name.
After shooting out of the country for what seemed like a decade, I was desperate to work stateside again. I didn't want to travel for work ever again. B-movie globetrotting had almost cost me an arm, and I was eager to return to the tetanus-free valleys of southern Oregon. Fortunately, state governments across the country had gotten sick and tired of American movies being shot in foreign warehouses and had instituted various incentive packages. My home state of Oregon was offering a 10% rebate incentive to entice prodigal productions to come back home. Better than a sharp stick in the eye. Mike Richardson, the founder and president of Dark Horse Comics and Entertainment, The Mask, Hellboy, was another Oregon resident and had already taken advantage of the rebate package. We'd known each other since his company produced the first Army of Darkness comic books back in 92, and we were eager to work together, particularly on a homegrown project. Mike had been friends with a writer named Mark Verheiden since high school, and the two collaborated on several projects going back to the very early days of Dark Horse. After the Army of Darkness comic, which Mark wrote, Dark Horse and Verheiden joined forces with Renaissance Pictures, i.e. Sam and Rob, to produce the movie Time Cop in 94. You see how Hollywood works? It's really just a big tangled web of schmoes who keep running into each other over and over. I hadn't been directly involved with Mike and Mark on a film project yet until Mark remembered the adventures of Alan Ladd. Alan Ladd was a well-known radio and movie actor in the 40s and 50s, best known for playing the hero in the classic western Shane. He's not as well known for the 9-issue DC Comics series that featured Alan Ladd as himself in a variety of adventures. The premise of gullible yokels enlisting an overblown actor to thwart evil had already seen the big screen with films such as Three Amigos and Galaxy Quest, but Mark's spin on it followed Alan Ladd's lead by having the actor play himself, and that actor turned out to be me. In Mike Richardson's office, with Mark at his side, I recapped what I thought was their plot. Okay, guys, let me get this straight. A small town is cursed with a monster, so they kidnap Bruce Campbell thinking he would be an authority on monsters, but he turns out to be a worthless asshole and almost ruins everything. Exactly, Mark nodded. I'm in. Where do I sign? Mike Richardson had already made a deal with video distributor Image Entertainment. With Dark Horse holding all the creative cards, I would only have to deal with Mike and Mark, who were thoroughly rational human beings. Now we're getting somewhere, I thought. Bouncing ideas back and forth, we were all in sync that the film would be set and shot in Oregon. The monster, however, wasn't such an obvious decision. Bigfoot seemed like a good fit for the region, but not necessarily for the story. Since I was a resident of southern Oregon and familiar with the local history, I wanted to make the creature more relevant to the area. In the mid-1800s, the entire infrastructure of my region, including gold mines, was basically built by Chinese immigrants. I started investigating Chinese lore in hopes of finding a suitable candidate, and a protector of the dead popped up, a former tofu salesman who went on to become immortalized as Guan Di, the Taoist god of war and protector of the dead. Seeing Guan Di as a vengeful spirit that haunted those who disturbed the peace, I thought, that's it. That's our guy. The elements came together, and the premise of the story, to be called My Name is Bruce, was established. In the past, a mine collapsed, killing all the Chinese laborers inside. The mine and consequent graveyard has been protected by Guan Di until modern-day locals disturb the miners' resting place. Guan Di then materializes and systematically hunts down the local bumpkins. Described as a giant red-faced warrior wielding a halberd, Guan Di was not a character I had seen on screen before. And even though our movie was bound to be campy, at least our monster wasn't going to be your run-of-the-mill vampire, zombie, or demon. Welcome to Gold Lick. Generally speaking, there are a few fundamental rules of filmmaking. One, never start making a movie until you have a completed script. Two, never start making a movie until you have the funding. Three, never use your own money. Four, never shoot on your own property. Okay, so I blew all four and started before anything was ready. With a pending fall book tour solidly committed, I had to move forward on the project or it would be delayed until the following year. I needed help, so I brought in Craig Kiff Sanborn, my indentured artist, who had recently finished putting the finishing touches on my Make Love book and was begging me for money. I added that, just for effect. He also had some experience scouting and securing locations, not to mention the ability to do eight other jobs, so Kiff was a mainstay during prep. We scouted the nearby town of Jacksonville, Oregon, a historic mining town. The entire town is a National Historic Landmark that had experienced a boom in the 1860s when gold was discovered. The actual history of this small town fit nicely within the backstory of My Name is Bruce, and its status meant that the buildings still had much of their bygone charm. Unfortunately, our rigid timeline meant we would need to film smack dab in the middle of the local Brit Festival, a popular music jamboree that the town had absolutely no interest in interrupting. In fact, the city charter itself actually forbade issuing film permits of any kind during the festival. I guess you could say we were Brit out of luck. I wasn't expecting this and had to quickly adjust what my vision for the movie was. I finally said, you know what? In Man with the Screaming Brain, I took over a Russian military base and built a backlot on that. I got property. I'm going to damn well build a backlot. Ignoring the numerous cardinal rules, I decided to fund the beginnings out of my own pocket until I could be reimbursed. After all, the deal was pending, right? What could go wrong? When I told Mike of my executive decision to build the fictional town of Gold Lick on my property, I was met with an ominous silence. Realizing that he had probably stopped breathing, I explained to him that Gold Lick was supposed to be a dilapidated small town. It wouldn't need new fixtures or four walls, and it could be totally ramshackle and funky. After a noticeable gulp for air, Mike replied, "Well, I just hope it doesn't look like crap." We had budgeted for location rentals and set decoration, but we hadn't planned on building an entire town square from the ground up. It was a crazy notion, but I was so desperate for a return to my roots that I wanted to literally make a movie in my backyard. I got what I wanted, all right. I got it in spades. So did my wife. The ensuing chaos of excavation, construction, and self-financing would become so stressful that the experience actually sent Ida to the hospital, fearing she was having a heart attack. Thankfully, she was not, but during the shoot that followed, Ida could barely contain her chronic throbbing scorn for my ridiculous scheme. Convincing Mike to go for it was one thing. Convincing my ailing wife to allow it was another, but convincing the municipal government to let us do it was the most difficult of all. Towns without a history of filmmaking are a double-edged sword. On one side, you have an excited citizenry, eager to give you the key to the city. On the other, you have a bureaucracy so unfamiliar with filmmaking that everything you say is completely alien. Trying to convince the local planning commission to let us build a series of semi-modular, temporary structures that violated more building codes than an inspector could count was a crazy notion. The commissioner's initial response was, "You wanna build a what?" Admittedly, there was no precedent for my outlandish request, so I took Oregon's film commissioner up on an offer he had made only a week earlier. "Bruce, if there's anything you ever need, you just let me know." I called him up. "Do me a favor. Help this local commissioner guy out. He thinks we want to build Dollywood or something. He's just trying to do his job, but he needs to learn about the bogus nature of movies and sets. We're going to dismantle the damn thing when we're done." I never heard another word about it. Crossing my fingers and concluding that we had been issued a don't ask, don't tell permit, I cut the ribbon and authorized the construction of Gold Lick immediately. The task of building the three or four structures that we weren't officially building was another exercise in true indie resourcefulness. New store-bought lumber was out of the question due to the budget, so I put an old-fashioned ad in the local paper. "Got wood? We'll haul away scrap lumber in trade," meaning for free. The response was mind-boggling. Calls came in from all over the valley. One guy had 16 feet of old fencing, another fella had an old deck, and it went on like that until there was enough material to fill two 24-foot trucks. Brother Don came over from Michigan to help gather the lumber, mainly because Kiff was sarcastic and irritable, and I wanted someone else to talk to. For the next several days, the three of us drove around southern Oregon, loading up every old board, plank, beam, slat, and toothpick we could get our splintered hands on. My own land was not without its own share of usable wood. The lower part of the property had once housed the original homestead from the 30s. The decayed lumber salvaged from the site had great character and wound up being perfect for the ancient Chinese cemetery and mine shaft we also had to build. As if God himself wanted to smite me for shooting a film on my own property, a lightning bolt shot down from the heavens one night and split a beautiful pine tree right down the middle. We were all in the house at the time and heard the massive explosion. Don swears he saw it happen. Within a week, that once stalwart pine was a dead skeleton of brown needles. Rewind to a few years earlier. I met a group of local woodworkers who owned and operated a portable Swedish lumber mill that could have been a prop in a Hellraiser movie. To make a living, they would hook up this wonderfully efficient machine to the back of their pickup truck and take it wherever someone wanted raw timber milled. I engaged the services of these portable millers, and they dragged the carcass of the pine to a nearby clearing. "Nice piece of wood. Shame about the lightning." "What size lumber would you like?" the miller asked. We decided on Western town-style slats. The beautiful ponderosa provided enough wood to face an entire building. To my surprise, the lightning strike altered the color of the wood itself and gave that batch of lumber a unique character we never could have gotten otherwise. Production design by Mother Nature. But the real gold strike came from down the road. I was driving home after scouting an area outside of Jacksonville and spotted a faded sign on the side of the road that read, "Items for Sale," and provided a local phone number. Upon closer inspection, the sign was leaning up against a motley assortment of old metal, which turned out to include a miniature train engine and a small gauge rail track. In My Name is Bruce, the collapsed mine bookended the story. The mine should have a cart and a track poking out from the rubble. Intrigued by the weird stuff on display, I called the number on the sign and spoke to a curmudgeon named Lowell. "Yeah? What do you want?" he asked, not sounding happy about the call. "Well, I saw your sign out front, sir, and I thought you might have some stuff that I'd be interested in using or even buying."
"Eh, hang on a minute."
Moments later, Lowell emerged, roaring on his ATV through a cloud of dust, asking again, "What do you want?" "Well, sir, I'm making a movie, and we need some cool old stuff to dress our sets." Lowell grumbled a bit as he opened a couple of gates.
"All right, follow me."
Up the driveway was a wonderland of vintage vehicles and tarnished farming, construction, and industrial equipment. Lowell used to mine on his own property, so he actually had old mining equipment in addition to the stacks of rail tracks. Seeing the drool seeping from my mouth, he asked,
"So you're building some buildings and supposed to look rustic? Is that what's happening here?"
Yeah, exactly."
"Well, come on over here." My wife made me buy this, and I don't know what the hell to do with it.
Lowell opened up a shed and revealed a hoard of wood that had been taken off a barn. Weathered but still solid, it was exactly the type of stuff I was hoping to find. I want all of it, I told him. I walked around a gate that everything I wanted to buy and loaded my cart with corrugated steel, 9x12 beams, roofing materials, metal signage, 1930s Rambler, even a doggone windmill. In his 70s, Lowell was a hoarder who had finally decided to sell off his collection to fund other aspects of his life. I needed a bunch of stuff to build a town. The timing was perfect. Lowell, of course, had his own bulldozer, forklift, and flatbed, so he was even able to deliver. To ensure that nobody died from a rotting piece of wood causing a set to fall over, the key framing and everything sunk into the ground was purchased brand new. But the siding, facades, and picturesque charm all came from the collected resources. Finished off with some antiques, a wooden Indian, and a large fountain, Gold Lick took shape. All this out-of-pocket business was a bit over the top, as my wife will attest, but I was hoping to put enough pressure on the wallets to make sure this deal did not fall apart. It was definitely a white-knuckle situation, but the deal got signed, and the official cash began to flow. Townsfolk. There was one final element necessary to complete the return to the solid days. There wasn't much of a point shooting a movie in my backyard if the cast and crew wasn't full of like-minded individuals and fun-loving shemps I called friends. Naturally, I started with Ted Raimi. I like working with Ted because he makes my acting look subtle. He had already developed an elderly Chinese character who would be perfect for the caretaker of the mining graveyard, and I knew he could add a certain amount of satirical sleaze to the role of my agent, Mills Todner. Thankfully, I didn't have to pay him for each role. The part of Bruce's ex-wife went to Ellen Sandweiss, who endured our shenanigans back in high school and suffered much, much worse as Ash's sister in the first Evil Dead. The roles of two close ranchers went to Tim Quill, a high school Army of Darkness alum, and to Danny Hicks, who played the infamous Jake in Evil Dead 2. The challenge in casting was to avoid members of the Screen Actors Guild. 5 years earlier, Ted had changed his status in the guild to Financial Core, a seemingly insane decision to become a fee-paying non-member. A SAG card is considered critical to professional actors, and I thought Ted had lost his mind by apparently turning his in. The allure of FICOR is the option to work both union and non-union jobs. In return, you forfeit the right to vote and to get a SAG award, neither of which ever applied to me anyway. Interestingly, it was two conservative presidents of the Screen Actors Guild who championed this notion over the years, Charlton Heston and Ronald Reagan.
Well, thank you, Ronnie.
Unions aren't an option when you're counting pennies. So the only way to keep My Name is Bruce on budget was for me to go FICOR and open the door for non-union actors. If I wasn't union, nobody else had to be union. This was to be the first completely non-union movie I had done in decades. I'm not saying it was good or bad, as I've been a union member for most of my professional life, but it was the only way we could have pulled it off monetarily. Without union restrictions, we were able to fill the rest of our cast with Oregon actors. The quaint town of Ashland was nearby, so we had access to the many actors and resources utilized by that town's annual Shakespeare Festival, which is a full-blown operation. Grace Thorson, our leading lady, was a trained Shakespearean actress and played our seemingly untamable shrew quite nicely. Taylor Sharp, the movie geek who kidnaps Bruce, was plucked right out of high school theater. Anybody who auditioned but didn't get a part was given the offer to be a silent resident of Gold Lick, i.e. an extra. Aspiring actors made eager extras, and their enthusiasm helped give our fictitious town an additional layer of personality. Now all the movie needed was its monster. Our costume designer turned us on to Jamie Peck, a local prop maker and costumer for children's theater productions. His repertoire included crafting strange masks and animal costumes and performing in them. Jamie was the perfect combination. Not only could he create the Guan Di mask, but he was also big enough to play the Tofu Titan himself. That's known as win-win. The fabrication of Guan Di was a joint effort between Jamie, the costume designer, and Melanie Tooker. Mel specialized in special effects makeup and had transformed me into an elderly Elvis for Bubba Hotep. When she wasn't turning Ted into some decrepit Chinese caretaker or building blood-spurting dummies, Mel was responsible for the monstrous elements of Guandi's appearance, including the gruesome hands and neck. All the pieces were finally in place. It was time to roll in Gold Lick. Hearts of Dorkness. The general public remains fascinated by the filmmaking process. So Hollywood continues to pump out behind-the-scenes documentaries and featurettes about the various tricks of the trade. I wanted to jam-pack the DVD edition of My Name is Bruce with as much stuff as possible, so I brought Mike Callio up to document the making of the film. Callio was an independent filmmaker in his own right and very capable of spearheading the documentary. Callio edited all the behind-the-scenes footage together and presented it as if the My Name is Bruce experience was a descent into madness. Winking at Hearts of Darkness, a filmmaker's apocalypse, the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, Callio called his featurette Heart of Dorkness, a testament to the trials and tribulations of low-budget filmmaking. His take on the production was prophetic. If a production has money, shooting on location is not a problem. You can afford to tame a wild area to suit your needs. You create a way in and a way out. Tents and mobile toilets are set up, and a massive base camp of trailers and equipment trucks create an ad hoc gypsy camp. You can make things happen. If you don't have money, it's man versus nature. You're at the mercy of whatever irritable flora and fauna are lurking in the area. My Hobbit House became the VIP club for the actors, and the extras claimed the area around the trampoline as their domain. A former garage became the makeshift production base camp, and my office was defiled to become the green room slash hair and makeup stations. A few odious trailers were brought in to line the perimeter of Gold Lick and serve as storage workshops for costumes and effects makeup. In 2006, high definition wasn't standard yet, but it was definitely up and coming. My director of photography, Kurt Roth, was a veteran Evil Dead shimp and another old friend. We discussed the trending technology and decided to shoot in HD, mostly because it was all the rage. I wound up calling it HD-lay. No matter which format you're shooting in, you're going to have to change lenses a lot. With traditional film cameras, it's an easy 5-minute switchover and you're ready to go. With HD-lay, it was a schedule-screwing hassle. You had to take the lens off and do some strange back-focusing BS. Okay, it isn't BS, but it sure seemed like it when my night was wasting away while some chart came out. You had to put a thing on another thing to do some other thing so that that thing wouldn't expand and contract and make the first thing fall off. None of the above is an issue these days, but we were trying to be ahead of the curve, and we paid the price. Here's an interesting fact. Bees love lavender. Specifically, aggressive Oregon bees love the lavender growing on my property. Summer was the season to harvest lavender, and the crops on the southern slope were almost bursting. The catering truck was set up not far from the edge of the lavender, if only because the spot was flat and hidden from the camera. The bees were already swarming because of the lavender, but they love all kinds of herbs, and caterers tend to cook with lots of herbs. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme lured the insects toward the dining cast and crew. The lavender managed to keep the bees relatively calm, but it wasn't long before they got the taste of flesh. I watched as one bee landed on a piece of chicken, carved off a hunk with its chainsaw of a mandible, and flew away, struggling under the strain of the oversized chicken nugget in its grasp. A plate with meat on it would get attacked by an entire platoon of bees, so it wasn't long before the crew abandoned the catering area and ate lunch in their cars. The aggressive bees made lunch interesting, but their effect on production paled in comparison to the impact of plants. We filmed several scenes in the deeper woods, beyond the cleared safety of the Gold Lick backlot. Without money in the budget for proper greenskeeping, we were oblivious to the fact that we were dragging ourselves and our equipment through patches of heinous poison oak. Some people reacted immediately with red rashes. Even the ones with no reaction unwittingly brought the toxic oil back home, where it would spread to their allergic spouses and children. Poison oak got all over the cables that snaked through the forest, which meant that the poor grips and electricians working in the equipment trucks got infected even if they hadn't set foot in the woods. As a result of the slowish production pace, I lobbied for an extra day of shooting. The general response from the bee-stung, oak-infested crew was, "Fuck that, we're not coming back to your goddamn property." I conceded to the mutineers, and our last night of filming was in a public park, about 20 yards from a massive interstate.
Get off my land!
Production wrapped, and I headed straight to the airport to kick off my book tour. With no time to catch my breath afterward, I was off to Miami to film the pilot for Burn Notice. I returned to Southern Oregon in time for the holidays and saw with fresh eyes how My Name is Bruce had ravaged my property. A shredded driveway and trampled yard were lingering evidence of the production, but those could be repaired or left to heal on their own. I still had a goddamn town to deal with. There was never any plan or budget to have production demolish the back lot. For a while, the general store was left standing, if only because it was anchored to a storage container and could harbor my equipment that valued even a primitive shelter. The gas station facade attached to my office outbuilding was kept around so we could play cards and lollygag beneath the canopy. Soon enough, the cost of not building something to code became very evident. Nothing was sealed. Nothing was caulked. Camera-ready coats of stain and paint had done little to keep the materials from becoming saturated by the ultimate enemy to structures, moisture. The windows were warping. One of the doors practically imploded, and metal siding began to peel away in sheets, so I eventually got a contractor to take it down. The only really smart thing I did in building this dumb backlot was to ensure that everything was bolted together and that no concrete was poured. We could just take it apart. The town of Gold Lick is a fading memory now, and Ida is in good health. To make My Name is Bruce, I crossed a few lines, but at the end of the day, there's only one true cardinal rule in filmmaking, and it's simple. There are no cardinal rules. The only business truth that continues to reveal itself in my everyday life is that I've never made money without spending some first. Don't be afraid to sow some seeds. The arts are always risky, and if you want to be part of the process, you have to accept risk and live with it. Mercifully, the film gods smiled enough to sell about 100,000 DVD units of My Name is Bruce, well enough to cover the roughly $2 million outlay. That's what it's all about, returning money to the investors so you can get it back and do it all over again. Chapter 13, Rise of the Master Cylinder. When I was a kid, I read Sad Sack comic books. I could relate to the main character, down on his luck schmo in the U.S. Army, just trying to make it through his day. The guy was nothing special, with no super skill set. He was born on this planet and wore a plain wool uniform. Sam Raimi read Spider-Man comics and became well-versed in that universe. His main guy was also an average schmo from Queens, New York, but he gets bitten by a radioactive spider, becomes a web-slinging superhero. A little different from my guy. It's a good thing it wasn't the other way around, because Sam landed one of the primo directing gigs of his era, the motion picture adaptation of Spider-Man. Apparently the project had been languishing for years, changing studios and directors. I was impressed as hell when I found out that Sam got the gig. Hollywood gets this stuff wrong all the time, but this was a good fit. Sam was intimately familiar with Spidey's myth, he could direct special effects all day long, and his visual style was long influenced by comic books anyway. I was mostly pleased for Sam in that he's always had an epic sensibility. He loved things that were big and complicated, and this movie could finally let the magician within Sam out of the box. Entering the Ring. Selfishly, I informed Sam that there was no way in hell he was going to make this highly anticipated epic movie without letting me play some kind of meaningless part. For the film, Sam threw me the role of ring announcer, and I was off to my fitting on the Sony lot. My part was a little Las Vegas-y, a little over the top in both look and delivery. The wardrobe department gave me a flashy, heavily shoulder-padded gold jacket and put my look over the top with a Cadillac logo dangling on a chain around my neck. Scenes in big movies like this aren't really rehearsed, they're storyboarded. And on any given day, the workload is judged more by shots than page count. The sequences involving my character all take place in an amateur wrestling ring. Between 1,200 extras, stunts, and choreography, there were a lot of moving parts. In the van, on the way to the set for my first day of work, I glanced inside an open soundstage and saw none other than Sam's self-proclaimed classic, attended by several serious-looking men in mechanic overalls. "That's Sam's car, isn't it?" I asked knowingly. Earl, the driver, looked back at me nervously. Why do you ask? I then realized that Earl, a loyal teamster, wasn't going to spill the beans. For all I knew, Sam had issued a gag order about his beloved Delta now playing the role of Uncle Ben's car. Oh, that's okay, Earl, I reassured him. Just curious. Earl dropped me at the corner of stages 32, 33, and 35. The backlot was a beehive of activity, really looking like it did in the movies, with all kinds of crew members driving, pushing, or pulling some ridiculously cumbersome piece of equipment in every direction. The only things missing to complete the cliché were a couple of Roman soldiers casually walking by, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. I collared the first person with a walkie-talkie who approached our van. Excuse me, which one is the Spider-Man stage? I asked, oblivious to the actual scope of the production. The assistant director smiled at me. Spider-Man is on 10 stages. You're the ring guy, right? Yep, that's me. I think you're in 33. Let me check. She barked into her headset, then waited for the information to be passed along and up the ranks until she got a reliable answer. It took some doing. Productions like this are pretty much a military operation, very segmented and individually goal-oriented, with a sometime Byzantine chain of command. Yep, you're in 33. Head over there. Someone will meet you. Inside stage 33, which was ancient and enormous, the place was already loud and warm from 1,200 wrestling fan extras shuffling and chit-chatting. Bullhorn-wielding assistant directors were shouting orders and reminders to the anxious crowd. Across the large ring set, I could see Sam behind a bank of video monitors. He looked really busy, and our handlers on set didn't want us wandering around, randomly bugging the director, even if he was an old pal. Sam started the wrestling sequence by filming the wider, more establishing shots first. After a week of this, finding out whether I was even in a given shot became something of a game. Sam had 5 cameras among the throngs in the arena, so it was anybody's guess. When in doubt, keep acting, I figured. Eventually, I caught Sam during a break. He looked tired but excited. I asked him what it was like to take filmmaking up to the next level, to the A-list. Sam smiled and shrugged. I'm doing the same stuff we did in the Super 8 movie days. I just have a lot more money to play with. Whatever Sam did, it worked. Spider-Man opened to a record $112 million. It's not as big as the oversized mega openings of today, but it smashed a box office record or two at the time. Ushering in the sequel. With the massive success of Spider-Man, you could bet your Buster Browns there was going to be a sequel. This franchise was off and running. Naturally, the second film had to be bigger, better, with more villains, more stunts, more everything. Naturally, I had to invite myself into the cast. The second time around, Peter Parker's romance to Mary Jane intensifies, and he tries to see her in a play on Broadway. But since he's so busy saving the world, he's late to the show. That's where I come in. My role as the snooty usher is to intervene and keep the tardy playgoer out of the theater. Tobey Maguire was a nice chap. He was a little confused when he saw me back again playing a different character, but he was happy to play along. Hey, Toby, great to see you again, I exclaimed, genuinely happy to be back. Looks like it's time for me to play another pivotal role. Oh, yeah? How so? Toby asked, trying not to be snotty. Well, as you recall, in the first one, Peter Parker wanted to be called the Human Spider. My character changed it, calling him the Amazing Spider-Man, so technically, I named your character. Toby's smile faded a bit, and he arched an eyebrow. Yeah, I guess. And I love how this new part is pivotal, too. Is it now? Toby asked, his expression back to smiling again, no doubt bemused by my audacity. Yeah, in this scene, Peter Parker tries to get into the theater to see Mary Jane perform, right? Right, so, tries. That's the operative word. The snooty usher won't let Peter in late. Technically, he's the only character who ever defeated Spider-Man. Toby rolled his eyes. The scene went fine, and I got to see the finished film in, of all places, Sofia, Bulgaria. I was there filming the modern-day classic Man with the Screaming Brain. My partner and old Raimi family friend David Goodman was with me, and we both lamented to Sam that we wouldn't be around to see the opening of his very anticipated sequel. Somehow, Sam pulled a few strings, or a whole ton of strings, and arranged for a screening of Spider-Man 2 for our entire crew and their families in a brand-new 400-seat stadium-style multiplex in Sofia. This type of theater seems normal to most of us, but it was a rarity in economically burgeoning Bulgaria. I am of the opinion that the second installment of the Spidey series really hit the nail on the head. It was just the right combination of myth, romance, action, huge set pieces, and humor. Our private audience oohed and awed the whole way through. The only depressing thing about the entire affair was when the lights came back up and our humble crew had to get back to work on our crappy little movie. Deja vu. Back in high school, I had a French teacher named Elizabeth Tessem. She was le grande dame of teachers. Mrs. Tessem had been teaching so long, my mother was also one of her students. Mrs. Tessem lived her teaching. She loved everything French, mostly speaking it during class, and she created a very fun learning environment. Who knew I would enjoy a French class? It didn't hurt that Sam Raimi and an old friend, even by high school age, Matt Dixon, were also in the class. We were very happy to create and perform French skits, demonstrating our amazing grasp of the language, but mostly overacting and doing cheap gags. When Sam tracked me down for my bit in Spider-Man 3, this was immediately what he referred to.
Okay, listen, pal. We're going to basically do one of those skits we did in Mrs. Tessem's old class with the maitre d' only as Peter Parker trying to get a table.
Say no more, Sam. It's the perfect trilogy for my appearance in this franchise. I named him. I defeated him. Now Spider-Man, a superhero, comes to me, a mere mortal, for help. How often does that happen?
Not very often, Sam agreed, mostly just to end the conversation.
Okay, so it's pivotal. My role as the maitre d' is pivotal.
Look, pal, you can call it whatever you want. Show up Monday morning and do your job.
Click. Sam had hung up. I pumped a fist in the air. Nailed it! My scene in Spidey 3 was a personal fave, in that Toby and I could actually let the scene play. It wasn't some quick bit with extras and mayhem all around. Toby was amused by seeing me on set for the third time to play yet another annoying character. Of course he's back, Toby grinned. We can't make a Spider-Man movie without Bruce Campbell. You're starting to understand how Hollywood works, Toby. Our scene played out as planned with the usual additions, tweaks, and changes that Sam makes all day long, every day that he shoots. I hope Madame Tessem would be proud of the end results. Spider-Man 3 took a lot of flack. It was a bigger, more convoluted story with maybe one too many villains, and it went a bit dark for some. Still, for me, it's hard to put in words how delighted I was to watch Sam, my boyhood buddy and filmmaking fraternal brother, direct one of the most successful movie franchises in history. There were superhero movies before Spider-Man, but Sam's series truly set that particular genre in motion for decades to come. I'm not a film historian, but I sense that Spider-Man also represents a turning of the tide, or taste, where even A-list movies are now B-movies conceptually. Believe me, if your hero is bitten by a radioactive spider and starts web-slinging from buildings, that's not only a B-movie, that's a 1950s B-movie. I'm just happy that genre fare is no longer frowned upon in the world of entertainment, and that we're finally seeing how popular fantasy, horror, and sci-fi stories really are.
Chapter 14. Ashes to Axis.
I was no stranger to Miami, Florida. Thanks to both Make Love to Bruce Campbell Way and Man with the Screaming Brain, I spent a nice chunk of the time touring the nation in the mid-aughts. As an international outpost at the tip of a massive peninsula, Miami was an obvious destination for each tour. As it turned out, attendance at both of these appearances consisted of merely a handful of fans and a fistful of empty seats. I have a great excuse for the Screaming Brain debacle. The Emmys were on. It was Game 7 of the Baseball World Series, and there was a hurricane watch in the area. That's a hell of a trifecta. The Make Love event slash bust in Miami had no such competition. The weather was great, it was a good store in a prime location, and nothing was on the tube. Still, folks just didn't show up. I was baffled because in Orlando, at a recent event, fans were out the door and around the block. Perhaps it was Miami's incredible collision of cultures that blotted out the influence of deadites upon the local consciousness. Whatever the reason, I concluded that trying to promote or further my career there wasn't worth the time or the effort, so a new rule went into effect. Never go back to Miami. If you're watching a movie, this is where the screen would cut to black and a title card would slowly fade in. 1 year later, the phone rings. Hello. Hi, Bruce. Barry here. I have an offer for you to be a regular on a new cool TV show pilot. Oh, yeah? Where does it shoot? Miami. That's a pass. I explained passionately that I was not only done with episodic television, but I was also done with Miami and its bad juju. I was really enjoying life in the boonies of Oregon, returning to my roots, making a couple of homegrown movies and doing cameos in the films of old colleagues like Sam Raimi and the Coen brothers. You gotta understand, Barry, Jack of all trades left a bad taste in my mouth. Episodic TV is too much work for too much heartache. Let's just treat television on a case-by-case basis, Barry advised. The script is really fresh, the role is perfect for you, and it's just a pilot. Now, a pilot is the first episode of a newly developed TV series. It's a proof of concept that helps a network gauge whether the premise has any marketable potential. As a rule, most TV programs never get past the first episode. An actor's reaction to getting cast in a pilot changes over the course of their career. When an actor's young and eager, they react with, "Hooray! I booked a pilot! This could lead to years of steady, well-paid employment." When an actor is old, bitter, and jaded, they tend to react with, "Oh, dear God, not another pilot. This will never go anywhere." An actor has to grow a thick skin, keeping pilots at arm's length. It's best not to get too close to something that might get killed off. I had been burned by pilots before, so it was only fitting that this new project was called Burn Notice. Fine, I agreed. You're right. It's only a pilot. It'll never get picked up anyway. America's penis. Southern, Central, and Northern Florida are like three different states or even worlds, and it would take decades before I understood that. My first real experience in Northern Florida came when I was scouting locations for Evil Dead 2 in 1986. Florida was a potential location for us because it was number three in film and TV production, and they had a capable film commission established. I'd never before considered Florida to be a redneck state, but some of my most disturbing brushes with racism happened when I was scouting the rural areas of Northern Florida. As an example, passing a gas station one day, George, our location guide, gestured out the window to an African-American man pumping gas. "Now, you see that fellow there? He's a good one." It took me a moment to understand what George was insinuating, because I had never heard anyone, even in lily-white suburban Detroit where I was raised, say anything like that before about a person of color. In the end, for a myriad of reasons, we didn't film there. Thank God. Central Florida was all about tourists, franchises, and retirees. Orlando is one of the most franchise-infiltrated cities I've ever seen, not a mom-and-pop operation in sight. Orlando was all about things that were familiar, safe, and fun. Theme parks on parade. It was like a Midwestern town dropped into the middle of a swamp. I nicknamed it Borlando. Miami wasn't even remotely close to a Midwestern sensibility. It's one of the most culturally and racially diverse places I've ever been. The Latin culture had taken hold long ago, and locals were very comfortable and proud of their heritage, whether it was Colombian, Cuban, or Venezuelan. On any given day, you would encounter far more people speaking Spanish than English. On more than one occasion, while struggling to communicate with someone who spoke no English, I was asked, "Why you no speak Spanish?" The explanation that about 5 miles outside the city of Miami, nobody speaks a word of Spanish would not compute. After 7 years there, on and off, my refrain became, "You know, I love Miami because it's so close to the U.S. Climate control. I was born in Michigan and spent the first 20-plus years of my life there. Now, maybe my body was hardwired for colder climates. Regardless, Miami was on the opposite corner of the nation from where I had chosen to live. Each year for 7 seasons, I had to transform from a pasty, rain-soaked Pacific Northwesterner into a tanned, semi-tropical beach bum. When you exit the plane in Miami, you are immediately blasted with a fireball of humidity, a smothering heat that I had never experienced before, like a jungle outpost. Well, then I remembered I was only an hour's drive from the Everglades, 1.5 million acres of tropical wetlands. Miami was a jungle outpost. At that level of mugginess and rainfall, the tropics were constantly decaying, yet trying to reclaim civilization at the same time. Lush vines were steadily strangling everything, while foliage mocked landscapers as they vainly tried to keep everything tight and trim. Avocados and bananas didn't stand a chance in Miami. Eat them immediately, or you were looking at a blackened mess 48 hours later. Not even a sealed freezer could stave off a moldy death. The rapid decomposition was so impressive that Ida and I had to change how we ate. We couldn't assume the groceries bought on Sunday would be anything other than ooze by Thursday. Stockpiling wasn't an option, so we shopped like Europeans, only buying what we would actually eat within the next couple days. Our bicycles were also under attack, from corrosion. Being so close to the ocean, the air itself was about 30% salt. Taking your bike into the shop to get de-corroded was just routine maintenance. After a few years, I became an old pro at living in the Magic City and an expert in harnessing the power of the sun. When I first arrived in Miami, I was still just another ignorant tourist. The character Sam Axe needed to be a tan man, the result of years of being a relaxed poolside lounger. How do you get tan quickly? A tanning salon, of course. The first time I went, the attendant knew nothing about the science of tanning or the mechanics of the beds. In retrospect, I shouldn't have been so willing to allow some babbling orange-colored dipshit bombard me with ultraviolet radiation. But my naivete didn't stop there. After being barbecued for way too long at way too high of a setting, I casually headed out to the beach to catch some more rays. It didn't take a dermatologist to help me understand why I couldn't sleep that night. Never again. Eventually, I would learn that 15 minutes of sunbathing per side was all I needed to maintain a tan but not destroy my skin. My co-star, Gabrielle Anwar, absolutely loved the Miami climate. She was like 5'3 and weighed only 7 pounds, so she was immune to overheating. The southern Florida climate was paradise to her. I think I only saw her sweat about 3 times, and it's possible that the sweat was added by the makeup department. Conversely, Gabrielle couldn't tolerate air conditioning. If a gust of cold, recycled air got too close, she'd start shivering, grab her set chair, and drag it into the balmiest, sun-blasted spot she could find. Adaptation is critical to survival. I needed to use every resource available to acclimate to the sunshine state if I had any chance of making it through an entire season of shooting. Over the course of the first couple seasons, we had to devise a wardrobe system that would allow me to stay as comfortable as possible, or at least hide how uncomfortable I was. This was a challenge because Sam Axe was a covert operative, an infiltrator, an impersonator. Sam couldn't wear short-sleeved floral shirts in every scene. He needed to be able to wear black, three-piece suits, and look cool, both meanings apply, doing it. When filming, I went through a lot of shirts. I'd sweat through a shirt after a few takes, so we'd swap it out for a fresh one. Over time, I researched lightweight undergarment fabric that would just whisk sweat away to another dimension, thereby giving my shirts another take or two. Wool socks counterintuitively kept my feet comfy and dry. Smart wool, the opposite of your father's dumb, scratchy wool, was my new best friend. Try it sometime. 'Cause think about it. Cotton is really the Jose Cuervo of fabrics. We've been sold a shabby bill of goods for decades. Cotton, in sock form, lights a fire in your shoe through incessant friction. Wool, for whatever reason, came to my rescue, and it's all I wear on my feet now, hot or cold. Clothing control was only part of what I needed to endure the blazing climate. I had to lose some weight. My gut had expanded in the decade of living in rural Oregon. Playing Sam Axe was great because he didn't have to be fit and agile like the character Michael Weston. He was defined by his penchant for lounging around with a beer in his hand. A gut was practically obligatory. Fat, however, is insulation intended to keep a warm-blooded body warm when it's cold. Gabrielle was comfortable on location because she has less fat than a rice cake. And Jeffrey Donovan was a lean son of a gun as well. In 7 seasons, I never saw him sweat. I soon discovered how necessary a pool was to preserving my core temperature and my sanity. For the first season, I didn't have access to a swimming pool, only a small speck of rooftop upon which I could get my 15 minutes per side of sunbathing. I'd end up drenched in sweat as I waddled through the house to the shower. After the first season, I refused to live in Miami without a pool. It was possible to chart the change of seasons by the temperature fluctuations in the pool. When I arrived at the beginning of a new season in March, water in the pool would be pretty much completely cold. A month later, the top inch of water would be warm.